called on House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Friday, April 29th, 2005. For the record, we're going to carry over House Bill 2688 over till the Wednesday hearing. So 2688 will not be heard today. I'm going to open a work session. You have in your packet some draft language that Elsie prepared for us on the issue of abused and neglected children, and this was a resolution of Congress to reject proposals that decrease the federal foster care funds provided to states. You can just take a moment to lay that in your hands. I'd like to, in a moment, have a motion to introduce that as a committee measure.
Mr. Chair, I'm delighted to put this forward as a LC draft 3600 and put forward as a committee bill.
Okay. Sure. Thank you, Representative. Greenlick moves that legislative draft 3600 be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Without objection, LC 3600 is ordered drafted as a committee bill. We will close the work session. And is Representative Crummel here? Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3404. Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummel, House District 26, which includes Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Mr. Chair, bring you House Bill 3404 as a concept that I think maybe, I'm hoping anyway, whose time has come. And I know that there are a couple of other people in the audience that would like to testify on this as well, so I will try to be very brief. What the bill does, and I've worked with the Department of Human Services on this concept, but what the bill does is that it will create a health savings account style program within the Oregon Health Plan. It would it basically directs the department to apply to the feds, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to seek approval for waivers to implement the proposal. The proposal would be to take a selected population, and it would be selected by the department, but I would view it as being, for example, the TANF, or Temporary Assistance to Needy Families population, or one of the other populations that they would put into place with this. And they would develop a pilot program to test whether the use of this type of a system could work, and hopefully it would save the state money and increase access for all persons for health care. As we know, one of the drivers of health care inflation is the fact that we have a cost shifting going on between folks that are on Medicaid and Medicare and the private sector. Now, it's not totally their fault, and it's just one of the factors. It's not the entire factor, but it is one of the big factors in terms of the cost shifting that occurs, and that causes health care inflation to go up. To demonstrate this, there is data that's available that shows from 1935 to 1965, healthcare inflation went up about, in that total 30-year period, went up by about 270%. And general inflation during that same 30-year period was approximately 320%. So they were very close together. And from 1965 to 1995, another 30-year period, same 30-year period, well, not the same, but another 30-year period, healthcare inflation outstripped general inflation almost 3-1. And one of the reasons, and you can go back and say, well, what happened in 1965 that would precipitate this? What happened in 1965 was President Johnson signed the Medicare and Medicaid bills into law. And then there were also some other changes that occurred in the early 70s that then caused the cost shifting to occur at an even greater rate. So actually, from about 1977 through 1995, the cost shifting and the health care inflation was much greater during that period of time.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question?
Representative Greenlee.
You mentioned Medicare and Medicaid in the same breath. Do you have a sense of the relative contribution to this inflationary factor that Medicare had as opposed to, say, Medicaid?
No, I don't. And the reason is because I was not able to extrapolate out the differences between, but they were both enacted actually with the same bill, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think most experts in the field would consider the inflationary effect of Medicare far more significant. Maybe if there was an inflation effect of Medicaid, it might be 5% of the 100%. I mean, Medicare was an open invitation of very high users to have free access to medical care.
Sure.
Medicaid's been much different, certainly. In its, I mean, I don't think you find any expert in the country that would think Medicaid was feeding that inflationary force compared to the tsunami of effect that Medicare clearly had.
It may not have, Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, and I'm not going to try to purport to you that I am an expert, nor am I an economist. I've just done some research on this, and this is what I found, and these statistics are from the U.S. Bureau of Statistics and Labor.
No, I think the statistics are correct. That's not the argument. The argument is the interpretation.
Well, the and I am mentioning them both in the same breath. At any case, Medicaid is also, quite frankly, an open invitation because there is nothing there for the recipients that it's, as far as they're concerned, it's free health care. And I think any time we hand something free to somebody, of course, your utilization is going to go up. And utilization both in Medicaid and Medicare has gone up, but that's really I don't want to argue with you about the because that's something that could be an ongoing and quite frankly argument that would never be satisfied. I think what I'm trying to do with this kind of a concept, though, is to see number one is that I think if we can help people understand that there is a cost of health care, it will help them be a little bit more judicious in their use of the health care system. I'm not trying to keep people from the health care system, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. What I'm trying to do is just help them understand that there really is a cost involved with health care. In other words, nothing is free. The goals of this program would really be to increase access for all persons to the health care system, not just for Medicaid recipients, but for all people, to increase the reimbursements to providers, because if we're saving money, then I think what we can do is at least, I would like really, and we'll need Congress's help on this, but I would really like to see us increase the reimbursements so that we can at least start covering the cost of care, because right now Medicaid reimbursements do not cover the cost of care. I would also like to see the reimbursements to providers made quicker, and I think utilizing smart card type of technology, it would be very possible that providers would be getting reimbursed for their services within 72 hours instead of having to wait 30, 60, 90, or 120 days. And then the fourth thing is to reduce the cost shift that currently is occurring in the healthcare system due to government regulation. So as I mentioned, I've worked with the department as far as the language in the bill, and it does have a sunset as well that I would point out in section 2, and this is so that it can be tested. If it seems to work, we could always repeal the sunset. If it doesn't seem to work, then let the program go away. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? President Boone.
So just to clarify what I thought you said, and I kind of spaced for a minute there. So anybody could do this then? People who are not on medical assistance programs?
Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, this particular bill is aimed directly at Medicaid recipients in the state, the people that are on the Oregon Health Plan, and the idea is to take a selected population. We're not just going to say everybody that's on the Oregon Health Plan is going to be covered in this fashion, but let the department figure out what population that should be, whether it's the TANF population or the fee-for-service population or probably not going to be the managed care population. But I think that there's some options in there. When I was visiting with the staff over at the Department of Human Services about the concept and about the idea, they were receptive to the idea, and they were receptive to the being able to select a population and then do some testing with it. Of course, we have to get the waivers from from CMS, but if we can accomplish that, then and if it truly does save money, then it might be worth it.
And do these monies then, can they carry over on the calendar year, or are these the ones that you have to use them by the end of the year or you lose them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, how I've envisioned this whole thing, and Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me for just a moment, is that a person would get a smart card, and the smart card would be populated with X amount of dollars. In a PFA, Pluck for America kind of way here, let's just, as an example, say $500. So on the first of the month, the card is populated with that amount of money. The person has to go to the doctor. They go to the doctor. They give them their smart card. The doctor's office swipes the smart card through the system, and then for the cost for that visit then is you take the deductions for whatever the contract calls for. So if it's 50% or 70% of what's normally reimbursable, and that's what's deducted from the smart card. So let's say the bill was $50. So now the person's populated card, the next time they go to the doctor, it's going to show that there's a balance of $450, not $500. And it would just do this throughout the month. They could use it for their prescriptions. They could use it for whatever medical visits they go for. And then the state would have a catastrophic insurance policy that covers for anything that's going to be over whatever the smart card is populated with. At the end of the month, excuse me, the beginning of the next month, then the card would be repopulated. And that would all done online. So now the next time the person goes and you swipe the card, the account shows that it's got $500.
Okay.
As far as when the person goes off of Medicaid or off the Oregon Health Plan, would they get to keep the money? No. And whatever they didn't use at the, so now, let's say in the course of the month they only used $200.
Mm-hmm.
There would still be $300 on the card. So all that has to be added to the card to make it $500 again is $200. If they've used all $500, then obviously the card is repopulated at the $500 level.
And one final question. I guess I was thinking that this was money that the people, that's why I was asking if people off the programs could do it, but the other kind of health savings accounts where you put your own money in and you can use it for other parts of medical payments. And at the end of the year, though, I think it goes away. You can't use it anymore if you have to either spend it down or whatever. But I don't think that applies to what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair and Representative Boone, no, that wouldn't apply to what we're talking about. And actually, on health savings accounts, the money does carry over. It's the medical savings accounts that the money does not carry over.
Okay, thank you.
And that's by federal statute.
Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, Representative Crummell, thank you. That's an innovative idea. Can we push a little on how you imagine having? We were just talking to Doug back here before about his account, and he puts a certain amount in a month until it gets to $5,100, or he can use that, and it's, of course, in this case, a pre-tax thing. And then his catastrophic insurance kicks in at about $8,000, something like that. So there's this gap between the $5,000 and the $8,000 that he's going to be expected to pay out of pocket, and then he's going to be expected to pay 10% of everything over $8,000 in that kind of model. A TANF person, and my guess is you'd add the $500 a month even if they spent $200, so you could get up to, because you want to get them up to, let's say, $6,000 in this case, you might do that. Would you expect that catastrophic insurance, the catastrophic coverage, would kick in for the TANF person when they ran out of their health savings account money, or would they be expected to pay the next $2,000 or $3,000 in order to make them more frugal about the use of the, and would they be expected to pay 10% of the expenses over $10,000 in a catastrophic incident?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, thank you for the question. No, is the short answer. First of all, the reason why a person is on TANF to begin with is because they don't have those kinds of that kind of funds, and I recognize that. The idea here is not to try to penalize those people. What I'm simply saying is that they've got a card, or they've got an amount of money that they're responsible for, and I would envision that there would be no gap, that the catastrophic insurance is going to kick in at whatever level is over the and it would probably be on on a per occurrence basis, but that catastrophic insurance is going to kick in whenever the person goes over the amount of whatever the card is populated with. Now, with that said, I mentioned before that I'm not an expert in how these work from a standpoint of that there's going to be, you know, all of the nuances, and that's why I want to give this over to the Department of Human Services, to the OMAP office, or Oregon Medical Assistance Office, for them to work out sort of the details and how that works. The vision that I have, and I'm sort of looking at it from the 30,000 foot level, but the vision that I have is that we're educating people to the fact that there is a cost for health care. They've got a certain amount of money that they're responsible for, but that there is a but that they're still covered for in whatever way the Oregon Health Plan is covering. But if this is a way that we can save some dollars, I'd like to be able to redirect some of those dollars to greater reimbursements for our providers.
Yeah, but I understand the way the incentive is supposed to work for Doug back there. He's supposed to be frugal about that use of money, because if he spends that money, he's now got a $3,000 chunk he's going to have to pay, and he's going to have to pay 10% of anything above that. So there's some incentive for him to behave maybe better or worse. There's some argument about whether that's the appropriate incentive or not. But if, and I think you're right about TANF, you can't expect a TANF person to pay $3,000. They just won't pay very much at all. Then I don't understand what the incentive is on the part of the TANF person. If they have this card, they can pay the doctor, they spend all their money, then somebody else is going to pay the doctor. I mean, it just seems to add a complication to the system rather than the incentive. I suppose the only incentive for the doctor would be they'll be more likely to take them because they can get some of their money up front. That might be an incentive. But I don't see why it would change the behavior on the part of the TANF person in this model.
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, I guess that's why we have it as a test.
Maybe you could organize it in a way, I suppose, that would give them some of the money if they didn't spend it. That might be a model that might provide some incentive into the system for them.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlee, actually the department staff did bring that up, and I'm not opposed to that. I don't know if CMS would let us use that kind of a model, but that's why we would be applying to them for the waivers. I'm not opposed to providing that kind of an incentive, or that they can, you know, that they can then when they go off of maybe part of the incentive is that when they go off of the Oregon Health Plan, they're able to transfer those dollars over to a private health savings account, or to their or as a contribution toward their, if they've gotten a job, towards their employer's contribution. I mean, there's a variety of ways that can work. So I'm certainly not opposed to that. But again, what I'm trying to do, and this is why I worked with the department on the language, on the current language in the bill, is to try to give them the flexibility. We want to run it as a pilot. It's got a sunset, but give the department the flexibility to really flesh out and work out the details on it.
Thank you, Representative Cameron.
At the risk of being practical, Chair, thank you. Representative Trumbull, you've in the bill you used the term health savings account, and
being familiar with medical savings accounts, and I think what we're, I'm not sure who Doug is in the audience, referring to somebody who's probably on a health savings account. If we're going to use that, why not turn it into, and that could be part of the incentive, why not turn it into a private health savings account where if that person can take, it'll always be theirs, they could take it with them as in a normal health savings account, could become part of their retirement if they didn't spend it by the time they're age 65. And I think we need to be careful, and I just circled the health savings account words in this bill, because if we're truly going to use health savings accounts, we don't want to have two different references to two different programs out there as the HSAs are coming on board in the private sector. If we're going to do that, I think we need to make sure they're modeled the same. That's a concern I'd have.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, I use the term health savings account for lack of another term, and understanding the idea is a health savings account style of program. If we need to call it something else, if we need to term it as something else, but it's that type of style, then I don't have a problem with that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to beat a dead horse, but
sure you do.
I think the backgrounding that we have here defines health savings accounts as an actual savings account that belongs to the worker, mm-hmm. can travel from job to job, and can be passed on to the heirs. I think the beauty, the creativity of this new plan is that it incentivizes the worker in that $500 to save by not seeing the doctor for every little thing. And I agree with Representative Greenlick and also Representative Cameron that somehow we've got to incentivize them in that $500 or $750 or $1,000, whatever it is, to save money. If they can spend all $500 and then be taken care of by another plan, it really doesn't incentivize them to not go to the office or to the emergency room every time they think of it. So I would encourage you to work on that part of it, that possibly we can. I think it's a great idea, and studying it certainly is to be desired. So thanks for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. As my friend, former Representative Bob Montgomery used to say, when the horse is dead, dismount. I'd like to think that this particular horse isn't dead quite yet, and I appreciate the comments that have been made about an incentive to the person that's on the Oregon Health Plan. I think that, I think leaving the some of the details to be worked out by the department is probably the way to go. But again, if there's some other nomenclature that we need to insert in here, and if we need to describe in the statute what the incentives are going to be, we certainly can. And I would work with the department to find what those incentives are. But I agree. The thing that's really unknown out there is, first of all, will CMS even give a waiver for this kind of a thing? And secondly, is that will CMS allow us to be using federal dollars as that incentive that then carries forward with the person that they get at the end in retirement, or that they can carry over into a private health savings account and that sort of thing?
You know,
those are really
the federal funds portion. If you're thinking about the 60-40 state fed match, you can carry over general funds. Have you given any thought as to where you envision this fitting in the spectrum of Oregon Health Plan and the various categories?
I have.
I think that we're successful. This is not going to work for the categorical population, so you're looking at a universe of about 29,000 people left, heading down to, I think, 24,000, 25,000. So where does this bill fit in?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I think that probably, and again, I'd like to give the department the flexibility to kind of determine what population this would be most beneficial to and how we can get the most bang for the buck from it. But I would think that probably the TANF population, the temporary and needy assistance, or temporary assistance to needy families, possibly the population that is on the family health insurance plan, or FHIP, and possibly in the CHIPS program, or Children's Health Insurance program. Those are the ones that come immediately to mind, and I have given some thought in terms of where it really would. I agree. I don't think, and I think the department agrees, I don't believe that the categorical group is really going to be a very good a good group for this particular
The CHIP group is a categorical group.
Pardon me?
The CHIP group is a categorical group.
Well, then I stand corrected.
Okay. All right. Hey, thanks very much, Representative Carmel.
Sure.
Steve Buckstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm Steve Buckstein, a senior policy analyst and founder of Cascade Policy Institute based in Portland. We've studied consumer-driven health care, the earlier medical savings account concept, and health savings account concept since the early 1990s. And I believe that this concept should play a much greater role in the future of Oregon's health care programs. Health savings accounts are designed to give individuals more control over their own health care. They recognize that we should use insurance for catastrophic events and pay directly for most routine health care situations. I'm talking in general, not just what this bill is related to, but for the whole system. I think this approach both reduces costs and gives more control to patients. The HSA philosophy says that patients should have choice, responsibility, and economic participation in all aspects of care. I'd be glad to address some of the questions that were raised earlier about that incentive system. The philosophy says that need should be determined by individuals, not by the system. HSAs represent a bottom-up worldview where patients come first. And I'd like to contrast the HSA philosophy to the managed care philosophy. You were talking earlier about the managed care population in the Oregon Health Plan. The managed care philosophy, as I see it, implies that medicine is too complex for patients to understand, whether they're general people in the community or people on the Oregon Health Plan, and thus that they shouldn't be bothered with the economics of their care. Managed care assumes that providers are more capable of controlling costs than patients are, and therefore that we should limit patient choices in the marketplace. Modern management theory abandoned this top-down approach long ago, and I think it's time for medicine and the Oregon Health Plan to look at abandoning it also. It's now time for the Oregon Health Plan to evolve into a patient-centered program in which recipients both take more responsibility and have more choice in managing their own health care. The critics of this concept, one of their criticisms is that HSAs are only for or only benefit the so-called healthy and wealthy in our society. I think the reality is much different than that. In the private sector, so far, HSAs have only been available nationally since the beginning of last year. In the private sector, more than one-third of HSAs already have been purchased by people who were previously uninsured. If we continue treating low-income Oregonians like they're incapable of making good health care decisions, they'll continue living down to our low expectations. But if we give them more choices and more economic incentives, I believe they'll surprise the critics and begin acting in ways that benefit both their own health care and benefit the taxpayers of Oregon. Other states are already planning to introduce the HSA concept into their Medicaid programs. Florida and South Carolina are two specific ones. In my written testimony, I crossed out and made a mistake on one state, but specifically Florida and South Carolina have proposals that they're going forward with to give Medicaid recipients their own personal accounts from which, and in some cases they're calling them medical benefit accounts, I believe, and I'm not sure if that's a legal term or what they're coming up with to get around some of the federal laws about HSA restrictions. But they want to give their Medicaid recipients these personal accounts from which they can choose a wide variety of health care services, including lifestyle programs such as smoking cessation, weight loss programs that can actually help them get healthier and therefore help them become less of a burden on the taxpayers if they're on these Medicaid programs. Oregon was a leader in rationing health care through the Oregon Health Plan. I believe that approach has not worked, and it's not worked for the patients, it's not worked for the taxpayers. It's very costly, it didn't achieve its goals. It's time to explore other directions, and that's why I support looking at introducing the health savings account concept, whatever you call it, into the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you.
Did you envision this program to cut across all of the recipients of the Oregon Health Plan?
Not necessarily. One state that I didn't mention, I think New Hampshire, is looking at it just for Medicaid payments for children. The equivalent of the CHIPS program here that you call it categorical, and I'm not an expert either, but they're looking at it just for children. Others are looking at it for, again, specific populations. I think that's why we need the test, and we need to look and see what populations might be most appropriate to start with.
Okay. Questions? Okay, thanks very much.
If I could address one other question about the incentives, there was one, I think, misstatement made earlier. Medical savings accounts are now replaced by health savings accounts. And both of them allowed the money to carry over. If you had a $2,000 savings account, for example, and you didn't spend any of it, it rolled over to the next year, to the next year. You could use it for retirement or long-term care. Health savings accounts are the same. As I understand it, federal law prohibits actually giving the cash, at least the federal portion of the cash, to Medicaid recipients. But I think, as the chairman mentioned, there are probably creative ways to get around that. And as Representative Greenlick mentioned, I think you do need to incentivize Oregon Health Plan recipients by giving them some economic benefit if they don't use all of the plan, and that can be letting them roll it over into the future, letting them take it and convert it into private health insurance if they get off the Oregon Health Plan, et cetera. So the economic incentives, I think, are important, but simply the choice of allowing them to have more direction and control over their own health care, even if there's no economic incentive, I think is a big factor in why you should look at this.
I really like the idea of something that a friend of mine was doing a long time ago, because they couldn't afford, there were two in the family and her husband was quite a bit older. He got Medicare and she couldn't afford any health insurance. So what they did was they put aside, I don't know where they picked the number, $200 a month, and put it in a special account for her in case she got ill. Well, it turned out she was quite a bit more needy of this money and should have probably had health insurance in that sense in that time, because they didn't build up enough to care for all what she needed. But the idea that if you use it and if you have that and then you can carry it over and you don't lose it, like it's not like you have to use it or lose it at the end, and you then can apply it to long-term care or whatever later, that I think is much more of an incentive to people to do this.
I agree, and I think it would be a very good investment, in a sense, for Oregon taxpayers. Some of our supporters, I think, sort of knee-jerk oppose the idea of giving money to welfare recipients, in effect, or Oregon Health Plan recipients. But you're in effect, giving them a lot of money right now without any incentive on their part to manage it well. Giving them some incentive, economic incentive, to manage it better, and giving them more choices to manage their own health care better, is, a win-win for both the patients and for the taxpayers.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buckstein, I think you're probably one of the more expert in this field that we've heard, that I've talked to. Are HSAs transferable in the sense that if you move from one retirement plan, health plan with an employer to another, can they be transferred? Or if you retire at 55 before Medicare and take on a plan individually, are those transferable in any way?
Yes. The standard HSA, we're not talking about Medicaid because it hasn't happened yet, okay, but the standard HSA, the worker owns the account. Okay. Even if the employer put in all the money to populate the account, okay, the worker owns the account. He takes it with him, okay, from job to job or when he changes health insurance.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to invite Barney Spate forward, please.
Thank you. morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, Barney Spade, Administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, Department of Human Services. Appreciate the opportunity to appear today on House Bill 3404. We have worked with Representative Kremel on the concepts behind this bill and the flexibility that is you see in 3404. We're deeply appreciative of the general direction provided in the bill would allow us flexibility to explore options in the development of the proposal, and as I indicated, this flexibility is important, primarily because, as previous witnesses have said, a lot of states are looking at the use of a health savings account model in Medicaid, but nobody has actually done it yet. So there are no existing models that could be readily replicated or that could provide guidance. The flexibility in the bill permits the department to examine which populations to include and how to structure the benefit packages that incorporate health savings accounts in both in ways that are both cost-effective and beneficial to the client. In addition, it allows the latitude for the department to work with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to develop a concept that is most likely to receive the necessary federal approval. Again, because this has not been done in any state, the work that we would probably be doing along with states like Florida and South Carolina with CMS would be, to some degree, somewhat groundbreaking. The development of a proposal for HSA and Medicaid will require extensive work. The department will want to involve many stakeholders, including managed care organizations, because I'm not convinced that you can't somehow link an HSA with managed care, with health care providers, with advocates, and with other partners. We're also going to need to work closely with policy field and budget staff and probably with some other agencies like the Department of Revenue, because there may be some tax implications regarding how we use the incentives. Because I agree with the conversation that the committee's had with the previous witnesses that there needs to be some sort of incentive built into this, and that's probably one of the biggest issues that in negotiating with the federal government is what kind of waiver and pilot approach could they give us. And because of this, we believe we're going to need to contract with a consultant to assist in the development of the proposal, and also probably work with CMS authorities. And we estimate the cost for this program about $131,000 of general funds for the biennium, which would be a one-time project manager and consultant services. The bill directs the department to develop a proposal, submit it to CMS for the necessary approvals, and implement no later than July 1, 2006. I would respectfully request that consideration be given to changing the implementation date to July 1, 2007, so that the development of this concept could take place simultaneously with the development of the next biennial waiver request for the Oregon Health Plan Demonstration Project. We would be then able to present the plan and a progress report to the 74th Legislative Assembly, and to the extent that any further policy options or adjustments that could be made then, and then, assuming timely federal approval, the pilot would be operational sometime in the 2007-2009 biennium. Given that 1 year delay in actually getting it on the ground, you might also want to consider extending the sunset for 1 year to July 1, 2011, which would then allow the 2011 session to review the performance of the pilot program during the regular session. With those comments, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to try to answer any questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
Barney, this is an intriguing idea.
Say again.
This is an intriguing idea, and I wonder if I was worrying about whether this was premature. We will have a bill coming over from the Senate shortly to take an interim process to take a much broader look at the healthcare system generally and OHP, I think, in particular. I suppose putting off the time might fit it better into that time frame, or.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, that's exactly why I would suggest that the bill as drafted indicates that, you know, no later than July 6th should we develop, submit, and then ultimately implement, or upon notification, the implementation. We'd like to clarify that we would not have to implement it before July of 2007. We can go ahead and start the work, and where we would do the staff work, the consulting work, the design work would be parallel with what we're looking at in any other changes in any other aspects of the program. And the intent is that we would probably go ahead and submit a waiver renewal, but there may be amendments to that waiver renewal process that come out of the 2007 session, and this would be part of that work, and hopefully could be integrated in any other changes that would be made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Brian.
Yeah.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3404 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3465. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3465 is repealing the sunset on the current mandate for health insurance coverage of emergency services. This bill is declaring an emergency and is effective upon passage. And also, for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the OMA could not be here today. At the bottom of your packet of materials, there should be hopefully a letter from Scott Gallant, the Director of Government Affairs, in support of House Bill 3465. Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members, and thank you also for allowing us to bring this forward as a committee bill. Very much appreciated. I am Jim Anderson with the here today representing the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I will be brief, and first I would like to give you a little history on this issue. For some of you, it's not new, but to go through it, in 1997, Senate Bill 911 was passed by the legislature, allowing an individual, and we refer to that individual as a prudent layperson, someone without a medical degree, being able to assess their own health in a prudent manner and determining if they need to use an emergency facility or not. Now, prior to 1997, some insurance policies dictated, had a list of certain types of health care issues that they would cover under an emergency setting. Now, it caused a lot of questions in people's minds. First of all, if I feel I have a condition, I go to an emergency room and I'm treated, is my insurance company going to cover it? Some insurance coverages, this is commercial insurers, had the need for prior authorization. In 1997, that bill that passed and is now present law allows a person on their own recognizance to go to an emergency setting and be treated and have the assurance that their commercial insurer would cover them. That's the way it is today. All this bill does is before you is get rid of a sunset that was initiated in 1997. 1993, that sunset was extended. And we are before you today asking for the sunset to be repealed. And the issue in 1993 was discussed thoroughly. Like I said, it was extended. And it was extended with the provision that at the time the Health Insurance Association of America representative here in this legislature and I got together and thought this issue is something that should probably not have a sunset on it. However, that representative was not quite sure how her members would address that issue. So we were going to work on it during the interim, bring this issue forward in this legislature. That didn't get accomplished during the interim. However, due to the good graces of the representative that now represents the American Health Insurance Plans, AHIP, which the former organization morphed into, we got together at the first part of the session decided that this issue was a good issue, that the sunset should be taken off this law, and therefore there is no opposition to this bill, and I encourage the committee's passage.
Questions? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3465, open a work session on House Bill 3465. May I have a motion, please?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
I move we pass House Bill 3465 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Anderson moves House Bill 3465 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Can we do this on the consent?
We'll take that motion in a moment. Call the roll, please.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
President Cameron.
Aye.
President Greenlee.
Aye.
President Tomei.
Aye.
President Butler excused. Chair
Volto. Chair votes aye. House Bill 3465, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Do we want to put this on a consent calendar?
You need an easy one to discuss.
Yeah, we probably might talk about it. Okay. So I would like to carry this bill.
I'd be happy to.
Representative Anderson, we'll carry the bill. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3465 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3050. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3050 is authorizing dentistry students and dental hygiene students at an education institute outside of Oregon to engage in clinical studies in Oregon. This has no referral, subsequent referral.
Okay, Doug Riggs.
And here comes the Doug to whom I was referring.
Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Cameron, I am the aforementioned Doug Riggs. Don't hold that against me. Mr. Chairman, I brought Rebecca Landau up to give you the details on why we need the bill, but I thought I'd just give you a very brief outline of why we're here today. For the record, I'm Doug Riggs, representing the Oregon Primary Care Association. As you probably all know, OPCA is a statewide association of federally qualified health centers, and we have 23 centers with 122 sites throughout the state in places like Vail, Bryanville, Astoria, Klamath Falls, Medford, Salem, Woodburn, and Portland. We are primarily structured to provide primary and preventative care, and in 2004 we provided care to over 200,000 Oregonians, almost, I think it was 900,000 total visits. So we are rapidly becoming an integral part of the low-income safety net for the state of Oregon. I did want to say that I think one of the benefits of federally qualified health centers is that we are a community-based and collaborative type of organization. We are required by federal statute to include the federal government, the state government, local interests, and the community in the provision of health care to low-income people, and I think we've been very successful. I'm going to let Rebecca talk a little bit about the bill, and then I'll follow it up at the very end talking about an amendment that we have prepared, which we think has consensus.
Thank you. I'm Rebecca Landau. I am a consultant with the Oregon Primary Care Association. I'm currently contracted with them to run a program that places students in underserved communities. And we've requested this bill because Oregon has a huge number of people who have limited access to dental services for a variety of reasons, some of which relate to their lack of insurance. Most of them are low-income people, and I think Doug is passing out a map of our health professional dental shortage areas that are federally designated in the state. 20 full counties in Oregon are designated as having a shortage of dental care for low-income people primarily. And an additional couple of counties have partial shortage areas in that. We have one dental school in this state, as you well know, that puts out about 65 or 70 students. I'm not sure exactly how many that is, but it's around 65 or 70 dentists each year, some of whom choose to go into community dentistry, but not all of them. The National Health Service Corps is a federal program that provides opportunities for students through scholarship programs, through loan repayment, after they're finished in health professions education. And through this program we call SEARCH, Student and Resident Experiences in Rotations in Community Health. In 2001, the Oregon Primary Care Association received a grant from the National Health Service Corps to run this program, to provide opportunities, to encourage students in all health professions, those interested in going into primary care, to obtain opportunities while they're in training, to see what it would be like to practice community medicine, community dentistry. And we are limited by the current practice statute from accepting dental students from other schools in the nation. We accept medical, nurse practitioner, PA students, and residents. They fall into a different category because they get licensed in Oregon before they come here, but we're able to take them. Students in training don't really need a license, and what we're asking for is the ability to accept a few dental students, because that's all it will amount to, really, and some dental hygiene students if we have the opportunity to accept them from accredited schools into opportunities to work here with a licensed Oregon clinician approved by the Board of Dentistry for 4 to 6 weeks during their educational process. And hopefully some of those people will come back and practice here. That's our intent. Some of them are Oregonians who are going to school elsewhere, and they'd like to come back here for opportunities, and we just can't offer that right now. So that's what we're asking.
Mr. Chairman, at your direction, we formed a work group that included the OPCA, Oregon Health Sciences University, the Board of Dentistry, and the Oregon Dental Association. We had a very productive meeting last week. There were some very good points raised, especially by ODA, and as a result, we've clarified the bill in the Dash 1 amendment. We also, since the Dash 1s came out, we've had one additional change that we'd like to submit to Ledge Council on Monday that would go into a Dash 2s. But in essence, what we did in the Dash 1s is we retained statute retained the existing statute for Oregon dental students as it currently is in statute. And we've added a new section both for dental students and hygienists for students who come from outside of Oregon. The Dash 2s that we would be proposing would also ensure that they come from programs that are already accredited with the Commission on Dental Accreditation. And we have no objection to that addition. And we believe, I think that you'll hear from later testimony that with those changes, that you'd have support or consensus from members of the work group on the bill. So with that, I would end my testimony and be prepared to take any questions that you might have.
Okay, just to be clear, the Dash 2s superseded Dash 1s.
Correct.
With this corrected language.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And we don't have the Dash 1s back because they haven't made it back from LC, but we'll just take the Dash 2s when they're ready. Who's on this work group?
We had myself and Laura Sisolak from the Oregon Primary Care Association, Brian Beringer from OHSU.
Just the organizations.
Okay, the Board of Dentistry and the Oregon Dental Association.
Did you include the Dental Hygienist Association?
Yes, oversight, they were involved as well.
Okay, yeah. All right. Question, sure. Representative Anderson.
Please, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just explain a little bit on here what geographic is, what that designation, and then are the non-designated just, give me a definition of both.
Okay. The shaded areas, the gray, are low-income populations within that area that have limited access, mostly because either there are adequate number of dentists, but they're not taking people on a sliding scale, or they're not taking people covered by OHP. The geographic means that there's just an absolute shortage of professionals, dentists, in that community. So I believe Wheeler County doesn't even have a dentist. So obviously they have limited access to dental care. Yeah. And the white ones are just areas that are not designated either because they don't qualify under the federal requirements for the population to clinician ratio, or nobody's really inquired needing a designation for whatever reason.
But many areas of those counties, the non-designated, could well be low income.
Could well be, yes.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jay Myers?
That's the last one.
Oh, great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jane Myers representing the Oregon Dental Association. And we did work on, I just saw the dash two this morning, so I guess what I would like to do is put some intentions on the record. The dash two is not written in a way that I understand it to actually amend, to add two new sections to the current statute. And the current statute creates an exemption for the students at OHSU primarily, or the students at dental hygiene programs in our state. And in the work group, we didn't want to mess that up in any way for the students in those programs, so we suggested that the amendments be new sections that would just address the out-of-state students, which I'm hoping that's what the dash two amendments do, but it's not clear to me. So that was the intention. And I don't think there's a problem with the Board of Dentistry doing, by rule, some of the kind of safeguards to make sure that the intention's carried out, because the intention was to give some kind of notice to the Board of Dentistry that with a letter of recommendation from the sending school that there's a student coming in, they're going to work in a clinic, name the clinic, and name the faculty member who's going to be supervising. There was also some mention of some liability coverage by the other school picking up some liability coverage for them. And some level of statement of level of competency for the student, because their dental students are four-year students, and primarily the hygiene students maybe 2 years. There are some four-year programs, but to make sure that there's an understanding of the student's competency coming in so that they're not being overextended beyond their competency range. So the Board of Dentistry could do those by rule, and we would encourage them to do that, and we just want to put that intention on the record.
Jane, so how would students be supervised who are living in some of these, or working in some of these far-off places like Maui County?
The way we understand that is that it's a fairly simple process for dentists to become an adjunct professor at OHSU.
So they would be covered. They would be supervised by dentists who are already in that area. It's not long distance.
That's
supervision.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative May. That's the way I understand it. The intention is, yeah, the direct, because it says direct supervision, so the dentist must be present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jane. So can I just clarify on these last two amendments? You got them this morning, so you're still processing them. But you're not objecting to the dash two amendments. You're making some observations on the record.
Correct. Just because looking at this, it says 2C, and then it's the current law already has a section 2C. So I would assume what they're trying to do is insert a new section 2C. But it's not real clear to me.
Okay.
And then renumber or reletter the other sections that follow.
Let's see how fast we can get these amendments, like, drafted, and then take a look at them and let me know.
I do think that's what we all agreed to, so I don't consider it a problem, but I just want to make sure that we want to preserve the current exemption for the OHSU and in-state students without causing them any unconsidered circumstances that sometimes come up when we make amendments to current exemptions.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much. We're going to bring this bill back up on Wednesday, so hopefully the amendments will be done by then, and you'll have a chance to review them before we vote this out of committee if the committee should so desire. Anybody else on this bill? Lynn? No? Okay. All right. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3050. And with no other business coming before the committee, I believe we're adjourned.
The other bills?
Excuse me?
The other bills on the agenda?
We completed the agenda.
Did I miss that? 2688 on the top?
We carried it over.
Carried it. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, we're adjourned.